from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
Did you offer your resignation?
I serve totally at the will of the President of the United States.
As FEMA comes under increasing fire for its role in the handling of Hurricane Katrina, we'll take a look at its chief, Michael Brown, former head of the International Arabian Horse Association. It's reported he was fired even from that. We'll also look at FEMA's disaster response in Florida and how the presidential election played a role in the distribution of hurricane aid there. And we'll look at how the Bush administration dealt with international donations for victims of Katrina.
Of the equipment of the National Guard in Louisiana that was not available because it's in Iraq. All of the amphibious equipment, amphibious boats, the National Guard in Louisiana is the only National Guard in the United States that has that kind of equipment. They're the only ones who need it, but they can't get to it now because it's in Iraq.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Louisiana, 25,000 body bags are now on hold for victims of Hurricane Katrina, last week's devastating flood as well. The actual death toll remains unknown, but officials saying they are preparing for the worst. A temporary warehouse morgue in rural St. Gabriel that had been prepared to take 1,000 bodies is being readied to handle 5,000. Earlier this week, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin predicted up to 10,000 people in New Orleans alone. A website set up by the Red Cross lists more than 117,000 names of people who have not been located. The majority of the people on the list are presumed to be alive and displaced to other cities. In New Orleans, the federal government is being accused of trying to censor the images coming out of the devastated city. The Reuters news agency is reporting the Federal Emergency Management Agency is now rejecting requests by journalists to accompany rescue boats searching for storm victims. In addition, journalists are being asked not to photograph any dead bodies in the region. Critics of FEMA's request compare the policy to the Pentagon's policy that bars reporters' photographs of the caskets and soldiers killed in Iraq. NBC News anchor Brian Williams is reporting police officers have been seen aiming their weapons at members of the media. And a blogger named Bob Brigham has written a widely read dispatch that the National Guard in Jefferson County are under orders to turn all journalists away. Brigham writes, quote, "Bush is now censoring all reporting from New Orleans, Louisiana. The First Amendment sank with the city." In Washington, President Bush sent Congress a request for nearly $52 billion in additional hurricane relief. The government also announced plans to distribute debit cards worth $2,000 to victims of the hurricane. Republican House and Senate leaders announced a joint investigation into the government's response to the hurricane. No Democrats attended the press conference announcing the probe. This marks the first joint investigation since the Iran-Contra probe of the 80s. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid of Nevada responded to the probe by saying, quote, "An investigation of the Republican administration by a Republican-controlled Congress is like having a pitcher call his own balls and strikes." Reid also questioned Tuesday if President Bush's month-long vacation played a role in the government's handling of the disaster. President Bush didn't return to Washington until 2 days after Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast region. In other news on Capitol Hill, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi assailed the head of FEMA, Michael Brown, who she described as having, quote, absolutely no credentials. Before joining FEMA, Brown spent 11 years as head of the International Arabian Horse Association. Pelosi said she recently saw President Bush and urged him to fire Brown. She said the president responded to her request by saying, quote, "Why would I do that?" When Pelosi said, because of all that went wrong last week, she said he replied, quote, "What didn't go right?" Questions are also being raised as to why the Bush administration chose to appoint a number of top officials at FEMA who had no experience handling disasters. FEMA's deputy director and chief of staff, Patrick Robe, was an advance man for the Bush-Cheney campaign and the White House. The agency's third highest-ranking official, Scott Morris, was a PR expert who worked for a Texas company that produced TV and radio spots for the Bush-Cheney campaign. In other FEMA news, the Salt Lake City Tribune is reporting last week, while New Orleans was desperately calling for help, FEMA sent 1,000 firefighters to Atlanta for an all-day class on topics such as community relations and sexual harassment. Instead of being sent to New Orleans, the firefighters were being trained to be community relations officers for FEMA. Their main job, once they got to the Gulf Coast, was to disseminate FEMA flyers. Some firefighters went to the press and complained they were being underutilized. FEMA lashed out at those firefighters who spoke out. FEMA spokeswoman Mary Hudak said, quote, "I would go back and ask the firefighter to revisit his commitment to FEMA, to firefighting, and to the citizens of this country." Federal medical authorities have announced at least five people have died from a disease related to Hurricane Katrina. They died from a bacteria that can enter the body through open wounds after a slog through polluted water. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is predicting more people will die from coming in contact with contaminated flood water. And in an update on a story we covered on Democracy Now! Yesterday, local county officials in Houston, Texas, are blocking plans for a new low-power FM radio station to be set up at the Astrodome to service hurricane survivors. The project had already been okayed by the Federal Communications Commission. This is Jim Ellinger, longtime community media activist based in Austin, Texas.
Despite having three low-power FM licenses that had been issued on an emergency basis by the Federal Communications Commission, as well as letters of support from the Houston mayor and the governor of Texas, Harris County officials who operate the Astrodome refused to allow access to provide an LPFM station for the evacuees' use.
Media activist Jim Ellinger, Prometheus Radio Project, had applied for the license that FCC granted. In other news, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has announced he plans to veto a state bill to legalize same-sex marriage. In Iraq, at least 16 people died in a car bombing in the southern city of Basra. Also in Iraq, U.S. forces have freed Roy Hallams, a 57-year-old U.S. contractor who'd been held captive for 10 months. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the fallout from Hurricane Katrina continues, more is being revealed about FEMA's role in handling the catastrophe and the qualifications of the people in charge of the agency. Michael Brown heads FEMA, and his official title is Undersecretary of Homeland Security for Emergency Preparedness and Response. President Bush merged the agency with the Department of Homeland Security in 2003. In the days after Katrina hit, Brown came under fierce criticism for his seemingly clueless and insensitive statements about the disaster that was unfolding in New Orleans. Last Thursday night, as tens of thousands of people waited in squalid conditions inside the New Orleans Convention Center, desperate for food, water, and security, Brown told CNN's Paula Zahn he was unaware of the conditions, even though TV images had shown the plight of the people all day. Brown then appeared to lay blame on the victims of the hurricane when he responded to a question about the probable high death toll, saying, quote, "Unfortunately, that's going to be attributable to a lot of people who did not heed the advance warnings." And yesterday, newly leaked memos showed FEMA waited 5 hours after Hurricane Katrina had struck New Orleans before requesting help to be dispatched to the region. Even then, Brown said the 1,000 Homeland Security employees could take 2 days to show up at the disaster scene. Brown's memo to the Homeland Security Director Michael Chertoff politely ended, "Thank you for your consideration in helping us to meet our responsibilities." According to the Associated Press, Brown's memo lacked any urgent language besides describing the hurricane as a near catastrophic event. Brown's memo also said employees would be expected to, quote, "convey a positive image of disaster operations to government officials, community organizations, and the general public." On Wednesday, Brown held a news conference and was asked to respond to calls for his resignation.
Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi has called for your resignation, and I'm wondering if you have a response to that.
The president's in charge of that, not me.
Have you ever offered your resignation?
Pardon?
Did you offer your resignation at
any time? I serve totally at the will of the President of the United States.
The Bush administration has staunchly defended Michael Brown. Last week, while admitting the federal response was not acceptable, Bush lauded Brown, saying, quote, "Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job." Yesterday, White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan became defensive when asked by reporters if Bush had continued confidence in Michael Brown and FEMA.
This is an attempt by some in this room to engage in finger-pointing and blame game, and I'm just not going to do that. I've made it very clear, and the president spoke about him last week, and his comments stand in terms of what he said about the great work that they've been doing round the clock, 24 hours a day, to help people on the ground.
White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. in these past few days. Information has come calling into question the qualifications of Brown and two of his top deputies. It turns out that none of them had any real experience in emergency management before they joined FEMA. We continue this discussion with Judd Legum of the Center for American Progress. He joins us in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Judd.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why don't you go through the list of the top men at the head of FEMA?
Well, right at the top, you have Michael Brown, and as you mentioned just a while ago, he was the commissioner of judges at the International Arabian Horse Association. To give you an idea of what he did there, he spent a year investigating whether a breeder performed liposuction on a horse's rear end. So I think that you clearly that 11 years he spent there probably didn't serve him too well when he transferred over to FEMA.
Was he fired from his job as heading up the International Arabian Horse Association?
Well, he was asked to resign, and I think that he was asked to resign, and then he offered his resignation. So whether that's firing or not, I guess no one will ever know. But it was a result of a lot of litigation that stemmed from his oversight of the association, and that's essentially what caused him to have to step down.
Judd, how did he end up as head of FEMA?
Well, as far as I can tell, his primary qualification seems to be that he was the college roommate of Joe Alba, who was the outgoing FEMA director, because prior to that, besides a short stint in a very small suburb of Oklahoma in the 70s involved with emergency management, he really has no experience besides being a member of this horse association or the commissioner of judges at this horse association. He was an estate planning lawyer, tax lawyer. So it seems to me that he knew the guy who was leaving, and that's pretty much how he got the job. Mm.
And the number two and three men in the agency in FEMA that's supposedly in charge of dealing with this disaster?
Well, the number two at FEMA, he was actually head of advance for the Bush-Cheney campaign. So essentially what he was in charge of is planning events. And what's interesting is the FEMA response actually reflects his experience, because what happened when there were, when Mike Brown made the request and said, finally, you know, we need 1,000 members from the Department of Homeland Security to come down and help out, they were really, they were charged with, representing and putting a good face on the relief efforts. And that was explicitly what Mike Brown asked for. And then when these firefighters volunteered from all around the country, they were made public relations officers. So I think really the experience of the number two guy there, the chief of staff, and even as you go down the line, the number three really was a media strategist, did work that for Maverick Media, which is the company that did campaign ads for the Bush-Cheney campaign. So if you look at the operation and how FEMA responded to it, they really responded to it more like a political campaign than a disaster.
Judd Legum of Center for American Progress, how does this compare to previous administrations like President Clinton? Are these usually political appointments in FEMA?
Well, they're political appointments in the sense that the president has to appoint them, and these people have to be confirmed, but they're not generally political jobs or people who have primarily political experience. For instance, James Lee Witt, who was the director of FEMA under Clinton, all of his top deputies had served for at least 3 years in the FEMA regional office. So all of the people who were in these spots had extensive emergency management experience within FEMA. And, of course, James Lee Witt, who's really widely respected, Republicans, Democrats, for his work during the Clinton administration, he was the director of emergency management for Arkansas. So there's a really big contrast between what FEMA was in the 90s and what it is now, which is really, especially at the top spots, a political dumping ground.
We're talking to Judd Legum, who is with the Center for American Progress, speaking to us in Washington. We're also joined by Farhad Manju, who wrote a piece in Salon.com called why FEMA failed. Ideologically opposed to a strong federal role in disaster relief and obsessed with terrorism, the Bush administration let a once-admired agency fall apart. Talk about this FEMA and the FEMA under President Clinton, Farhad.
Well, I think that your other guest sort of pointed out one of the things, which is that this FEMA is much more political. And that's how, actually, that's one of the kind of the defining factors of the failure here. When the Bush administration's FEMA sort of came in, when they came into office, they were determined to change things from the way the Clinton administration did things. Under the Clinton administration, there was a lot more coordination between the federal government and state and local governments in responding to disasters. I talked to George Haddo, who was one of the deputies in the Clinton administration's FEMA under James LeWitt. And, you know, he talked about how when they knew that a disaster was coming or when a disaster occurred, like the Northridge earthquake in California or the Midwestern floods, all of the kind of the principals who were in charge of disaster relief from the federal government, from the state government, from local government would meet in a room and talk about what should be done. And there weren't sort of people pointing fingers at each other and blaming each other. That's very different from what's happening here. And it leads to, you know, a complete breakdown in response and in coordination to the point where federal officials last week had no idea what was going on in New Orleans. I mean, they didn't learn, even though it was all over TV, they didn't learn until sometime in the middle of the week that there were people at the convention center who had no food and water and were waiting to be evacuated. So, and this was really sort of one of the things about the FEMA, about FEMA under the Bush administration, is that this kind of breakdown between in coordination was something of by design, because when the Bush administration came in, they were sort of determined to put disaster relief to make it a state and local response, to pull the federal government much more out of that. And you know, this goes along with their, you know, with a general conservative ideology of, you know, keeping state and local governments much more in charge. And I guess this is where it leads you, the failure we saw last week.
I want to ask Judd Legum about Joe Alba, who you were just talking about, the man who's quite close to President Bush, former head of FEMA, who could stand to profit from the catastrophe in the Gulf region. I just want to read you our headline yesterday. President Bush tapping Alba to head FEMA after he served as Bush's campaign manager during the 2000 election. He's Brown's predecessor. He headed FEMA until March 2003, just as the U.S. was launching the invasion into Iraq. Then Alba helped from a former lobbying firm called New Bridge Strategies in order to help clients, quote, take advantage of business opportunities in the Middle East following the conclusion of the U.S.-led war in Iraq. Now, Newbridge Strategies was also formed by several top executives from the lobbying firm then known as Barber, Griffith, and Rogers. The head of that firm was Haley Barber, who's now the Mississippi Republican governor. Earlier this year, Joe Alba signed on as a lobbyist for Halliburton subsidiary KBR in order to, quote, educate the congressional and executive branch on defense, disaster relief, and homeland security issues. And just last week, the federal government announced Halliburton would be hired to repair the Gulf Coast military bases damaged by Katrina. And now the Washington Post is reporting Alba is also helping Louisiana, quote, coordinated the private sector response to the storm.
Yeah, that's right. And what's interesting is that Alba actually beat Michael Brown, the current director of FEMA, down to Louisiana. He was there far in advance of when Michael Brown came down in Louisiana, essentially securing private contracts for his clients. And he recently, although the contract was signed before he started representing Halliburton, secured the agreement of the government to tap into that contract to clean up naval bases in the Louisiana area. So he's already paying dividends for Halliburton, certainly, and probably will for a lot of his other clients as this very large disaster relief effort continues.
We're talking to Judd Legum, who is the research director for the Center for American Progress, co-editor of the Progress Report. Also, Farhad Manju is on the line with us, a writer with Salon.com. When we come back, I'd like to ask you both to stay with us. We're also going to be joined by a reporter from the Florida Sun Sentinel to talk about how disaster relief was distributed, well, just before the highly contentious election of 2004, with Florida being a key battleground state, how that disaster relief aid was distributed in Florida. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country on Pacifica, NPR, and low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As FEMA comes under increasing scrutiny for its role in handling the New Orleans disaster, its response hasn't always been so sluggish. In the fall of 2004, with the presidential election on the horizon, the key battleground state of Florida was facing its second hurricane in less than a month. In response, FEMA awarded millions of dollars in disaster funds to residents of Miami-Dade County, even though the area did not experience the hurricane conditions. FEMA officials, the governor, and the White House steadfastly denied suggestions that politics played a role in the distribution of hurricane aid in Florida. But records contained in hundreds of pages of emails of Florida Governor Jeb Bush suggest otherwise. According to the documents, a federal consultant to FEMA predicted that a disaster could reflect poorly on President Bush and suggested his reelection staff be brought in to minimize any political liability. We go now to speak to Megan Omatz. She is a reporter with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, which first obtained the records and broke the story. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Talk about your understanding, how your paper, the Sun Sentinel, got the documents and how disaster relief funds were distributed right before the 2004 presidential election.
Well, we obtained this memo from a consultant to FEMA through the Florida Public Records Law. It was contained in emails to the governor. This consultant had directed it to some FEMA officials who then forwarded it to the governor's chief of staff. And in it, again, he did suggest that FEMA pay careful attention to how it's portrayed if in case Hurricane Francis was so significant that it created a huge mess for the president. This consultant was concerned that not all the blame for anything that went wrong be put solely on FEMA or the Department of Homeland Security, but that they at least come up with a strategy to convince the public or show the public that other agencies such as the Red Cross and state and local officials also have a responsibility to respond in these cases. But clearly they were very aware, I think, that they needed to respond well to this hurricane. A lot of people were hurt, and as you said, Florida was a very important state. I think they delivered billions of dollars here, certainly, and my paper was paid close attention to the money that went to Miami-Dade, which was incredibly excessive.
You have a quote in your piece, consultant predicted a huge mess of the FEMA director, Michael Brown, who says the men and women at FEMA don't give a patooey about who the president is or who the governor is. He said, whenever people say stuff like that, we're just offended by that because that's just not how we operate. He said that to your newspaper's editorial board.
Yes, that's correct. They denied even really following up on any recommendations from this consultant. The governor's staff said the governor never saw the memo. The reelection campaign said that they never received it. So basically the official line was that this was one man's personal thoughts, and it never went very far within FEMA regarding any of the considerations that he brought up.
You write about the time. I mean, this is just when the Republican National Convention was winding down. Hurricane hits. President Bush has only a slight lead in the polls against John Kerry, of course, winning Florida, key to the president's reelection. FEMA should pay careful attention to how it's portrayed in the public as a consultant. And you say in a September 13th memo to Governor Bush and other top state officials, Orlando Cabrera, executive director of the Florida Housing Finance Corporation and a member of the governor's Hurricane Housing Working Group, wrote after a meeting with FEMA that the agency was allocating short-term rental assistance to, quote, everyone who needs it without asking for much information of any kind.
Yes, we've done extensive reporting on the money that went to individuals after the hurricanes here, and a good chunk of that money is called rental assistance. It's supposed to go to people who can no longer live in their homes while they're being repaired, and basically the agency was giving this money, certainly in Miami-Dade County, to people who never had to move out of their homes at all because they didn't sustain serious damage. There have been 16 indictments in Miami-Dade County for fraud, for cheating FEMA. We've had a U.S. Senate investigation on this exact topic. And again, we just saw FEMA being very generous, again, especially in Miami-Dade, giving people money for supposedly broken televisions, washers, dryers, whole new wardrobes and rooms full of clothing and so on, or rooms full of furniture and so on.
It's a pretty remarkable piece you write. And Megan O'Matz, a reporter with the Sun Sentinel in South Florida. What about how the aid is being given out or how Florida is dealing with the hurricane now? We often hear about Katrina, of course, devastating Louisiana, New Orleans in particular, Mississippi, Alabama. What about how it's being dealt with in Florida and where did it hit? How bad is it?
Well, people probably don't recall this given the magnitude of what has happened in the Gulf Coast states, but Katrina did first make landfall here in Florida, sort of on the border between Broward County and Miami-Dade County. It brought a lot of rain. Certainly, it was not the magnitude of a storm it was once it reached the Gulf of Mexico, but it did cause some property damage here. I think local officials estimate that 350 homes were damaged or destroyed in Broward and Miami-Dade County, and that there were thousands of others that might have had some property damage, whether that's trees down or other minor problems in their homes. Now, interestingly, when if you compare Hurricane Frances, the government last year declared Miami-Dade a disaster area when there wasn't much of a problem. This year, they've denied that similar aid to residents of Miami-Dade for Katrina, and that's caused a lot of concern by our local members of Congress who believe this time the aid is deserved, and yet FEMA won't provide the money. Our governor has said he has thought maybe FEMA is gun-shy about providing the money now because whenever they offer this assistance, even though maybe 200, 300 people may need it, as soon as you turn on this application hotline for FEMA, thousands of people apply, and it seems like more money is given out than maybe should reasonably be expected.
Megan O'Matz is a reporter with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. We are also joined by Jed Legum of the Center for American Progress and Farhad Manju of Salon.com. Now, we're talking a lot about FEMA, which is subsumed under the Department of Homeland Security. FEMA was a cabinet-level position under Clinton, but lost that cabinet position under Bush. But should we just be focusing on FEMA? It is a part of the Department of Homeland Security. I wanted to go to a clip, Judd, of Michael Chertoff, head of the Department of Homeland Security, this weekend. And this is after the disaster has been going on for some five, 6 days. And Michael Chertoff held a news conference just before he went down to Baton Rouge and to New Orleans. And he responded to a reporter who asked about the delay in response.
You know, these are citizens soldiers. We have to get them mobilized and deployed. When we send the National Guard overseas, we don't tell them to pack up and leave in 24 hours unless it's some huge emergency.
Now, again, what he said, we have to get them mobilized, talking about the National Guard. When we send the National Guard overseas, we don't tell them to pack up and leave in 24 hours unless it's some huge emergency.
Well, I think that gets right to the heart of the issue. And if you look not just at Chertoff, but how President Bush and his schedule and Donald Rumsfeld and how he was behaving, there were several days that passed, really critical days, where the federal government did not consider this. Obviously, they knew that it was a major hurricane and something had happened, but they did not consider this a huge catastrophe, or as Chertoff later would call it, an ultra catastrophe. And it was that lag time, those period of times, that really caused a lot of the damage to people's lives. That's why people didn't get the aid they needed right away. That's why, you know, even by midweek, people like Chertoff himself and also Brown weren't even aware yet of people in the convention center, people elsewhere in the area who didn't have any food, any water, and were living in very dangerous conditions.
Farhad Manju, we also just got the report that on Tuesday, a group of people evacuated from New Orleans who were thought they were headed to Charleston, South Carolina, instead were flown into Charleston, West Virginia. In South Carolina, at the airport, ambulance waited, medical teams were waiting, but FEMA flew them into West Virginia. Do you know anything more about this?
I don't know anything more about that specific incident, although I did hear about it and saw it as a kind of another example of FEMA's incredible incompetence over this. I mean, one of the things that I write about in one of the articles I wrote about FEMA is, you know, how many groups wanted to offered help in the days after and before the hurricane hit, and they offered, you know, very specific kinds of resources to FEMA, and FEMA sort of never once tapped any of those groups, and in some specific cases barred people from who were intending to help from coming into the region and without citing many reasons. I mean, there are you know, dozens of these stories of people and organizations wanting to help and trying to donate various kinds of resources who were turned away by FEMA and other federal authorities.
In our next segment, we're going to be talking about the offers of foreign countries to help out the United States in this time of need, like Cuba, very experienced in hurricane damage management, offering to send up some 1,000 doctors who had these hurricane packs immediately since it is so close. They were rejected. But I wanted to read the National Weather Service message from 10:11 in the morning on Sunday. This is before the hurricane hit, 10:11 Central Time. Devastating damage expected. Hurricane Katrina. A most powerful hurricane with unprecedented strength, rivaling the intensity of Hurricane Camille of 1969. Most of the area will be uninhabitable for weeks, perhaps longer. At least one half of well-constructed homes will have roof and wall failure. All gabled roofs will fall, leaving those homes severely damaged or destroyed. The majority of industrial buildings will become non-functional, partial to complete wall and roof failures expected. All wood-frame low-rising apartment buildings will be destroyed. Concrete block low-rise apartments will sustain major damage, including some wall and roof failure. High-rise office and apartment buildings will sway dangerously, a few to the point of total collapse. All windows will blow out. Now, this is Sunday. Katrina hit Monday. This is the National Weather Service, the government's weather warning. Judd Legum of Center for American Progress, your response.
Well, and actually, you know, President Bush himself was personally briefed by that group and told of the damage himself, so he was well aware of it. And you would think that at that point, or even before, that's when resources should have been mobilized. But the reality was, for just to provide an example, a medical ship, a hospital ship, didn't leave the port of Baltimore on the way to New Orleans until the following Friday. So almost 5 days later, didn't even set sail on its way down. So really what you had is that again is a huge delay between when we knew that this was going to be extraordinarily severe hurricane and when help started to arrive. And it was that interim period where really so much of the devastation occurred.
I want to thank you all for being with us. Judd Legum, Center for American Progress, Farhad Manju, writer with Salon.com, and Megan O'Matz, reporter with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, for joining us. Just to read, CNN did announce this, add geography to the growing list of FEMA fumbles. A South Carolina health official said his colleagues scrambled Tuesday when FEMA gave only a half-hour notice to prepare for the arrival of a plane carrying as many as 180 evacuees to Charleston, but the plane instead landed in Charleston, West Virginia, 400 miles away. It was not known whether arrangements had been made to care for the evacuees or transport them to the correct destination. A call seeking comment from FEMA was not immediately returned. Now, I want to talk about the health situation in New Orleans. The death toll from Hurricane Katrina's devastation continues to mount. While there's still no official count, public authorities have estimated the numbers of those killed could be as many as 10,000. Adding to the danger and tragedy in New Orleans is the growing toxicity of the stagnant floodwaters laced with chemicals, dead bodies, oil, and human waste. On Wednesday, the Environmental Protection Agency announced the first results of floodwater samples show high levels of E. coli and lead. EPA Administrator Stephen Johnson told reporters that in all cases, amounts exceeded 10 times the safe limit and issued this warning.
Emergency response personnel and the public should avoid direct contact with any floodwater as much as possible.
As many as five people have died so far from contaminated floodwater, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Officials suspect they contracted infections after coming in contact with cholera-related bacteria. Last weekend, Democracy Now! Producer John Hamilton was in New Orleans and asked a local resident and physician, Dr. Tuti Shaban, if she thought the floodwaters around them were a health hazard.
I think it is. For my medical opinion, yes. I mean, we have corpses here. We have corpses that have been here for a few days. We have animal corpses. We have human corpses. We have sewage. It's just sitting here. This is a different climate than what people know. It's been over 100 degrees here every single day with this stagnant water. There are some fish in it, but it's some dirty water. I think it's going to be a serious health risk, particularly West Nile. We have West Nile already in Louisiana before this happened. We haven't had a whole lot of deaths, but we have had incidents of West Nile killing people, and I think that this still water is where those mosquitoes breed. And now we've got all these mosquitoes and all these people and all this dirty water, and I think it's just pestilence waiting to happen. I'm very concerned about this water and these conditions for the people that we do save.
That was Dr. Tuti Shaban speaking to Democracy Now! Producer John Hamilton in New Orleans last weekend as they rowed in boats trying to save people. New Orleans began pumping the toxic floodwaters into Lake Pontchartrain Monday. Michael McDaniel, the Louisiana Secretary of Environmental Quality, says it's, quote, simply unfeasible to attempt to filter the water before flowing it into the lake. The EPA granted the Army Corps of Engineers a waiver from treating floodwater before sending it into Lake Pontchartrain. Also complicated the cleanup are two major oil leaks found in St. Bernard and Plaquemine perishes, much of that oil has flowed into the Gulf of Mexico. Now people are asking questions about the environmental costs and whether the coastal waters will suffer long-term environmental damage as the death toll increases. How significant is this environmental toll? We're joined on the phone by Harold Zelliger, a chemical toxicologist and water quality consultant. He's investigated hundreds of toxic chemical exposures and environmental spills nationally and internationally. Welcome to Democracy Now, Dr. Zelliger. Can you just talk about what the water contains, the toxic soup?
Sure. You've mentioned, and others have mentioned, the biological components, the bacteria, the viruses, there are spores.
Are you on a speakerphone? Dr. Zelliger, are you on a speakerphone?
Yes, I am.
Oh, could you come off the speakerphone? It'll be clearer for us. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead.
How's that?
That's much better.
Okay. So we have the biological component, but and you also mentioned the oil leaks and the there's a huge chemical component here. New Orleans area is surrounded by petrochemical refineries, by processing plants, by manufacturing facilities, and a good number of these have been breached during the storm and ooze their content into the water that's now in New Orleans. I believe yesterday EPA announced that the levels of lead in the water were extremely high. So we have this enormous soup. Now, what does the soup do? First of all, the individual chemical components have their own toxic hazards associated with them. But my research and that of others as well has shown that when one has chemical mixtures, what can happen is could be even much more severe and much different from the individual chemicals. Let me be a little specific, if I may. When mixtures are studied, what their effects are on health, sometimes you get as much as 10 times or higher as severe a reaction as one would get to the individual chemicals. Another area we run into is that the target organs are different. In other words, say we have chemicals that are known to attack certain parts of the body. The mixtures often attack parts of the body never envisioned from a consideration of just single chemicals. We can study those, and I have studied those, and I say others have also, when we can define the mixtures. In this case, we can't define the mixtures. There are probably an infinite number of mixtures possible in that soup that's sitting in the city right now. So what I think one can expect is, in addition to the bacterial-borne diseases and viral diseases, we can probably expect some mysterious diseases or mysterious syndromes cropping up. This has happened to some extent after 9/11 and the air and the people who were exposed to air downwind from the World Trade Center. Some say, and I would agree, that Gulf War syndrome is another manifestation of this. Still another would be irradiated male syndrome. People who work with male and have been irradiated have symptoms that cannot be accounted for by testing the air that they breathe where they work. So I think one can probably expect to see some of this in New Orleans, and unfortunately it's impossible to predict what form it will take.
Harold Zelliger, what about people who are staying there? Well, first of all, healthcare workers, people who are cleaning out New Orleans, and those who simply are afraid to leave because they saw what happened to people at the convention center.
Out to these people. They have lost everything, and I understand their fear. And I certainly have not walked in their shoes, and I can't really feel what they're feeling. But they are like survivors of major catastrophes. Who was just afraid to leave, and a lot of these people, regretfully, don't have a sophisticated education. I think it's incumbent upon the officials in the New Orleans area to coax them out, not drag them out. To the extent possible, try to educate these people to the risks, and try to show them that by staying there, they are really risking their lives. As far as the healthcare workers and the response people, they should, I think, wear masks on their faces at all times. They should be, if they're walking through the water, should be wearing hip waders so that their skin is not exposed to this soup, because a lot of these chemicals will absorb through the skin right out of the water, even when the skin is not cut or scratched.
What about airborne disease?
Airborne is another consideration. That, and in fact, watching the images on television of the pumps pumping the water, just that pumping is generating an enormous amount of airborne contamination. The spray coming off it is contaminated with everything that's in the water. And as the waters recede and as the city dries out, starts to dry out, and again, we're looking at months down the road, they're going to get more and more airborne particulates and airborne chemicals from evaporation of those materials that vaporize. And when the solid materials are left behind, just the wind blowing will generate dusts, and these dusts will be extremely toxic.
Harold Zelliger, I want to thank you very much for being with us, chemical toxicologist. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we look at the international response, countries offering aid, what was accepted, what wasn't. Stay with us. Damon and Naomi here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. International donations have been pouring in for victims of Hurricane Katrina. Countries across the political and economic spectrum have responded. Germany and Italy have sent food. Canada and Singapore provided planes and helicopters. Greece is sending two cruise ships to house evacuees. Afghanistan and Armenia both offered $100,000. Bangladesh, $1 million. Sri Lanka, a recipient of U.S. aid, is offering $25,000 in cash. On Sunday, the U.N. announced the U.S. had accepted the U.N.'s offer of assistance, but the U.S. has not warmly responded to all donations. The U.S. was slow in accepting offers from Venezuela. Yesterday, Venezuela's ambassador to Washington said boatloads of gasoline are being shipped to the U.S. It'll be sold on the market rather than donated. Last Tuesday, Cuba offered to send 1,100 doctors to assist in the crisis. Cuba said the doctors could have been on the ground by last Wednesday, but the Cuban government announced the U.S. State Department rebuffed its offer of aid. We turn now to Phyllis Bennis. I spoke to her just yesterday in Washington, D.C. She's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and I asked her about these offers of international aid.
Cuba has offered, as it has in the past, direct and very focused emergency aid. The president of Cuba, Fidel Castro, offered specifically to send initially 100 and then later another 500 and eventually another 600 doctors, each equipped with a specially designed backpack with 24 kilos of specially designed hurricane relief supplies, medical equipment. The hurricane season, of course, in Cuba is always a very dangerous one, and the Cubans have developed some of the best systems in the world, recognized by the United Nations as being some of the best protection systems, some of the best evacuation systems, and their doctors know how to deal with hurricane victims. So they offered it first privately in meetings both in Havana at the U.S. Interest Section and in Washington at the State Department. There was no response. Yesterday, the State Department claimed that they have not turned down aid from anyone, and said a State Department spokesperson said specifically that there had not been an official offer from Cuba, and said that Fidel Castro standing in front of a television camera with doctors does not constitute an official offer. denying, of course, that there had been earlier private offers when the Cubans particularly did not want to make it a big political issue. They wanted to provide what they knew would be necessary. And the offer is being ignored by the United States. It's not even listed on the long lists of offers that have come from other countries. What's rather extraordinary is that the offers that have been accepted the most quickly are those that are duplicative of the kind of material that the U.S. military provides all over the world. So, for example, the U.S. has accepted transport planes from Singapore and Canada. They've accepted fully equipped cargo planes from Spain. They've accepted MREs from Germany and Italy. These are the meals ready to eat that the Pentagon provides to countries all around the world. That's what they're now accepting here. And what it says is, while we're fighting a war in Iraq, we have to depend on the charity of other countries, including donations like $25,000 from the tsunami-ravaged country of Sri Lanka, or $1 million from Bangladesh, one of the poorest countries in the world. Those offers are being accepted because while the U.S. is fighting a war in Iraq that we're being told is designed to make us safer, it makes it impossible for the U.S. to provide even their own citizens with this kind of basic protection.
The medical school in Cuba founded because of hurricane relief there?
There's an extraordinary history in Cuba during the major hurricane in 1994 that ravaged Central America. 4,000 Cuban doctors were sent to Central America to do relief work. When they came back, they were stunned at what they had seen, not only the devastation of the earthquake, but they had been working in poor rural areas where people had grown up in villages that had never seen a doctor. And the doctors themselves, when they returned to Cuba after their missions, were demanding that the government do something to help these impoverished communities throughout Central America. Taking that into account, Cuba transformed a former naval base that had been closed down 2 years earlier. I've actually been to that school. It's an extraordinarily beautiful piece of land north of Havana on the shore that was not being used. And they got funding and assistance from the King and Queen of Spain to build a brand new state-of-the-art medical school aimed at training doctors, initially in Central America, and it now is bringing in students from all over Latin America. Just about a month ago, it graduated the first class after a six-year training period of new doctors, where the young students are taken from Central American countries. They are fully paid. All of their supplies, their room and board, their uniforms, their clothes, transport for holidays back and forth to visit their families. All they have to do is commit to working at least 3 years in an impoverished community in their own country. And they are then fully equipped as doctors, licensed to practice throughout Latin America, and are sent back. And it's that kind of commitment that Cuba has really made a priority in looking at how they see hurricane relief. It's not just about sending relief when it's needed. It's about helping countries plan for the future. That kind of planning is certainly not what is on the agenda for the United States.
What about Venezuela and other countries, including, well, the whole body of countries, the United Nations?
The United Nations offer has been accepted, but we don't know whether they've been allowed to actually do anything yet. The Office of Humanitarian Coordination Assistance in the UN, OCHA, which is the UN's very experienced team of humanitarian workers, have offered to send logisticians, people that are expert in setting up systems, water purification experts, and others, all the people who clearly, from what our government has been able and unable or unwilling to provide in the hurricane areas, are desperately needed. The offer was finally accepted from the United Nations, as well as in the abstract, donations and offers have been accepted, but most of them are being turned down. There was an extraordinary report this morning in the Washington Post about the Swedish Swedish offer of a plane load full of water purification equipment and a fully ready-to-go cellular telephone system with the engineers to set it up, who were coming with their own food and water and equipment to put this in place, that would allow 5,000 calls simultaneously routed through Germany. They were working simultaneously with a German company to provide this, and it took 5 days for anyone in FEMA to even get back to them. and tell them what they would have to do before it could be accepted. So there's been a great deal of bureaucratic stumbling blocks to countries that are prepared today to send material today, to send money, to send troops that are trained specially in emergency work, to send equipment, to send supplies. All of it is being stymied by the FEMA bureaucracy. So there's been an extraordinary problem. On the other hand, it is an amazing admission for the United States that has, for this administration, that has consistently attempted to describe the United Nations as irrelevant, to undermine everything the United Nations is trying to do, particularly with the role of the new UN ambassador from the United States, John Bolton, for the United States to now admit that it needs assistance from the United Nations, and for John Bolton to admit that, as he put it, that sometimes the rugged individualism, as he put it, of the United States might not be enough. That's a huge admission of the failure of unilateralism of this country, that what all the people of this country have been saying, the war in Iraq is not making us safer. The war in Iraq is taking away our resources. The war in Iraq is the reason that one-third of the National Guard troops in Louisiana were not available because they were deployed to Iraq. Almost half of the equipment of the National Guard in Louisiana that was not available because it's in Iraq. All of the amphibious equipment, amphibious boats. The National Guard in Louisiana is the only National Guard in the United States that has that kind of equipment. They're the only ones who need it, but they can't get to it now because it's in Iraq. All but two of their rescue helicopters are not available because they're in Iraq. So the war in Iraq, this illegal unilateral war, has dramatically impacted the ability and capacity of the United States government to respond to this emergency, as well as the issue of FEMA and FEMA's own inability, led by Michael Brown, the former international director of the International Arabian Horse Association, which has shown itself incapable of dealing with this crisis. So the international acknowledgement by the United States that the most powerful, wealthiest country in the world is unable to support its own population in this dramatic moment of crisis for the poor and impoverished and overwhelmingly black community of Louisiana and Mississippi is a very stark reminder of the price we pay in this country, particularly the price being paid by the poorest and the communities of color for a war in Iraq and for the efforts of the United States to prove to the world that it doesn't need the rest of the world. We have seen that proved as a lie.
Phyllis Bennis, finally, one of the poorest countries in the world, Bangladesh, making an offer of aid, and the president of Venezuela, Chavez, Venezuela owning their gas stations in this country, Citgo. Can you talk about what they have offered?
Venezuela has offered cheap gasoline as well as heating fuel for hurricane victims, as well as doctors and humanitarian aid workers prepared to move into the area immediately. They're close by. They could be there within hours. This offer has not yet been accepted. The cash has been accepted because it was routed through the American Red Cross. What is astonishing, as you say, Amy, is that the poorest countries in the world, from the $25,000 offered by tsunami-ravaged Sri Lanka, which is still digging out from the tsunami of last Christmas, to, as you say, one of the poorest countries in the world, Bangladesh, which just offered $1 million. Those offers are being accepted.
Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies speaking to us from Washington. And that does it for today's broadcast. You can go to our website for all of our hurricane coverage at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper. We also want to thank Uri Galed, Angela Alston, Rebecca Silver, Sean Clark, Orlando Richards, Tyshawn Black, Susie Salami. DemocracyNow.org, again, is our website. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!